Bruce Pratt joining us for this week's edition of Sports Lit 101. What do you got for us today there, Mr. Pratt?
Well, I got a book that when I saw it, I said, well, I should get this and check it out. I didn't know if it would be exactly what we were looking for, but I think it really is. And it's a very broad look at a very complex and very complicated issue in the history of American sports, and that is the rise of the African-American female track athlete. If I were to ask someone on the street who Mickey Patterson was, I would guess that 99 out of 100 would have no idea. If I ask who Alice Coachman was, I think a great number of people would know that. You ask them who Wilma Rudolph is, and you get a lot of people, oh, yeah, she was a track star in the 60s and 70s. Well, Mickey Patterson in 1948 was the first African-American woman to win an Olympic medal for the U.S., and Alice Coachman was the first one to win a gold medal. And they began what was a long and arduous journey for African-American women to be allowed to participate in track and field at the highest levels in this country. And it was as much a racial, and this is what shocked me about this book. Yeah, that it was a racial discrimination, nothing surprised me about that. But that it was also that successful black women in athletics had to, as much as possible, look, sound, and act like white women, so that the white women who participated in these sports would not somehow be feminized in a different way. And the research that Kat M. Arial, and it's A-R-I-A-I-L, Kat, C-A-T, who wrote this book, she's in the history department at Tennessee State, looked at was not only the racializing, the genderizing, and the feminizing, but how once these women started to become successful, they became tools of our propaganda machine in the Cold War, being used as examples of how wonderful America was and how open and free and how everybody in America could be what they wanted to be, while at the same time, all those other forces were keeping them from being who they could be. Now, a lot of what we know traditionally about track and field in America for black women is that the preeminent place they came from was from Tennessee State University, the famous Tiger Bells that were coached by Ed Temple for years, also from Tuskegee and from Albany State in Georgia. So they primarily, the African Americans in track were women from the South. And they were primarily people from the rural South, some from the cities, but mostly from the rural South. And they were encouraged to be, they had to be absolutely, the world had to make sure they were heterosexual, that all their activity was heteronormative, that when they weren't in their track uniforms, they were dressing in the right kinds of dresses and skirts and coiffing their hair a certain way and the like. But they were also expected to aspire to do track for a while and then go into something worthwhile, quote, like teaching or nursing, all those things that were at the time, we're talking about from maybe the early 1940s through the early 1960s, that were sort of reserved for women in general in this country. But what happens is after 1948, after the 48 Olympics, the U.S. Olympic Committee is suddenly forced to take more black athletes than it wants to. In fact, they were taking athletes, white athletes, over black athletes when the white athletes had not performed as well at the Olympic trials. They were simply left off. And the people choosing this, oddly enough, on the women's side, were mostly white women that were associated with the AAU. So you have this odd dynamic going on that says you can be a track athlete, but you must go to a segregated, you must go to an all-black college, live in a segregated society, but when we need you, you need to sort of step outside that and pretend it doesn't exist. So as the Cold War goes along, there's more and more pressure on these athletes to suddenly be the spokespeople for an America which doesn't fully value them as human beings. One of the examples on the male side of that was Mal Whitfield, who was a 800-meter runner, extraordinarily good African-American, and a member of the Tuskegee Airmen, who had to get you know, leave to participate in these games. And as soon as they could use him as a goodwill ambassador, they'd ship him and Louis Armstrong and other famous African-Americans off to visit the world to say, you know, this is not Russia. We're not the Soviet Union. So we could finally get to where we have track meets with the Soviet Union in the 60s and 70s. And these black women then suddenly become the anti-Soviet women. And the press, both the white press and the black press, which includes the famous The Defender out of Chicago, the African-American, Afro-American, which I think, if I remember correctly, is out of Pittsburgh. Maybe I have them backwards. Started making a point of how lovely all the African-American track stars were, how comely Wilma Rudolph was, how graceful Mae Fags was, and then later how the slim, attractive, and athletic Wyoming Tyus. They wanted to be athletes. They wanted to succeed, but they kept finding all these things standing in their way. And then as soon as they became successful, became renowned, when even in the segregated South, there were parades and tours when people like Rudolph and Coachman came home from the Olympics, they were mostly segregated parades, though the white mayor might give them a bouquet or something. And then they were immediately told, okay, now you got to change your clothes and you've got to become this ambassador or that ambassador. So this book is really fascinating in that it's a very deep dive, if you will, it really shows that constantly these people were between a rock and a hard place. And I just didn't really understand, you know, I always knew about the racial discrimination, but I didn't really understand about the feminization and the fact that even the black press saluted how beautiful a woman was, how attractive she was every time they mentioned her track skills.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, it's I think you're going to really like this book because I was worried at first also that it might be a little too on the academic side, and research is meticulous and a lot of the accompanying material and the appendices and things are really good. And her list, her bibliography for this is fantastic. I imagine it's a little bit like Changing on the Fly. This may well have been the origin of this woman's PhD dissertation, which she later turned into a book. I don't know. I'm trying to reach her to see if we can get her on as a guest. But I think it'll really spin a lot of heads because I was alive. I mean, I remember Wilma Rudolph winning those. I was 9 years old. I was really into track. I remember her winning those medals in Rome. Of course, we didn't see it live. It was on tape delay. But I don't remember, even when watching that, and not that I would remember from that age, I remember them talking about her antecedents as track stars. And what some of them went through to compete is just absolutely astonishing amount of showed that it had an astonishing amount of courage. It's quite a fascinating study.
Excellent. The book is called Passing the Baton. What's coming up on future editions of Sports League?
Okay, we got a bunch of things going. We're obviously, after the NCAA tournament is over, we're going to talk to Bob Walsh about his book, Entitled to Nothing. We're going to talk to Eric Sherman, Two Sides of Glory, about the 1986 Red Sox. I don't know if you've had a chance to read that yet.
Not yet, no.
It's really, really good. And I think what Dan Shaughnessy said about it in his column a while back is true, that this does what no book about 1986 has done before. How Eric Sherman got people like Bruce Hurst, who really never wanted to talk about this, to talk for 4 hours with him. All those questions about that game, you know, should Stapleton have been in? You know, should Schiraldi have been pitching? You get from the players who were there their take on all this. And I think that I'm a diehard, long line, for my whole life, Yankees fan. I'll tell you this, I have a lot deeper understanding, I think, of who Roger Clemens is in a much more admirable way. I certainly learned a lot about some of the other players that I didn't know. Oil Can Boyd is just fascinating beyond belief in this book. So it's really, really good. I mean, what all the players say is that that most people don't understand how incredibly intelligent Boyd is. They say, you know, he would pop off and say funny things, and they say he's as funny a guy as you'd ever meet. But every one of them, they say, you know, his intellect, don't ever underestimate it. He's really, really smart. That's really good. We're going to talk to a guy named Adam Eshan Ali about climate change and the way it affects outdoor hockey and outdoor sports in America, and also discuss the sustainability of the NHL and their sustainability project. So we got a lot of stuff coming up. There'll be more than that, but that's the near future.
And we ordered some new books yesterday from our friends at University of Nebraska Press. One of them is called "The Best Team Over There: The Untold Story of Grover Cleveland Alexander and the Great War." I am absolutely fascinated. Can't wait to read that.
Yes, and then today I got information about another. I ordered a memoir called Clubby, which is about a minor league clubhouse attendant from then that looked really good. And so, yeah, Rosemary said as soon as those books are available, they'll be on their way to us.
Yeah, another one we're going to be reading is 1962, Baseball and America in the Time of JFK from author David Krell. And I didn't mention this one, too. Yesterday we were going back and forth, but if we can get a hold of this one, it looks great, too. The Pride of Minnesota, The Twins in the Turbulent 1960s by Tom Henninger.
Yeah, I think I may have ordered that, but I'll double check.
Because that looks great. And I love those Twins teams of the 1960s with Harmon Killebrew and Dean Chance and Zoilo Versailles, Bobby Allison, Rod Carew, of course. They were great.
Oliva.
Yes, such good teams.
I think, didn't Carmen Pasquale finish his career pitching for them too, I think?
Camilio Pasquale?
Camilio Pasquale, not Carmen. Camilio Pasquale. I think he might have finished up with them.
He might have. I know he was with the Senators there for a while in the 60s.
Yeah, really colorful guys.